up, mama. Wheels up, mama.
Welcome to Sunday Gothamites. Adam J. Sachs, your host here. Join me as we go beyond the pale. Every Sunday at noon on WBAI, listener-supported free speech radio. Streaming live on the internet, WBAI.org, and go to our website, beyondthepale.org, for a full archive and links. And don't forget the Pacifica app for iPhone, where you can hear live radio streaming in the sister markets around the country. But before we continue with our exciting show today, we ask you to do your part. As our listeners, we depend on you, cherished listeners, to support WBAI and its mission. There is no great multinational conglomerate backing us up, rather, it's people power. And Pacifica Foundation, launched by pacifist Lou Hill in 1949, the first ever listener-funded radio station, it called for radio that would foster understanding amongst nations and individuals, encourage creativity and promote innovation, and provide an uncensored distribution of news. The mission that we can continue to foster understanding between cultures and diminish conflict amongst peoples. So we ask you, please, call our pledge line, 212-209-2950, dig as deep as you can, and we have some exciting offerings as a recognition of your generosity. There is WBAI Pacifica on a Stick. It's a thumb drive with greatest hits of WBAI going back 5-6 decades, many important, crucial voices and moments in American history. And we also offer a package, Socialism in the USA, which comes with an accompanying CD and another CD, so that's two actually, diagnosing the political and economic malaise that has led to a seemingly continual decline in the strength of the democracy and the continuing failure to establish an economic democracy in the United States. So we do encourage you again, that pledge line, 212-209-2950. Moving on today, we have a packed show today. We will be covering and discussing the retrospective of the graphic comic artist Art Spiegelman at the Jewish Museum. Then we will be discussing with an important community leader the New York perspective on the Ukraine-Crimea crisis, specifically the New York Russian-Jewish perspective. And then finally, before we bid farewell to you, we will be moving on to some recent cultural important happenings we should bring to your attention, one concerning the great Gustav Mahler and another concerning Die Volksbühne, the People's Theater in the Yiddish language, which still continues in New York. But now we would like to welcome to the show today. We are honored and pleased to have with us to welcome back Professor Mariana Hirsch. Welcome to Beyond the Pale.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Professor Hirsch is the William Peterfield Trent Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University and a professor in the Institute for Research on Women, Gender, and Sexuality. She is the immediate past president of the Modern Language Association of America, born in Romania, educated at Brown, Columbia, and taught at Dartmouth previously. So just to mention some of her books, which we encourage our listeners to look into, The Generation of Post-Memory, Writing and Visual Culture After the Holocaust, Ghosts of Home, The Afterlife of Chernovitz in Jewish Memory, co-authored with Leo Spitzer, Rites of Return, Diaspora Poetics, and The Politics of Memory. And Professor Hirsch also was one of the early voices to bring critical and scholarly attention to the work of Art Spiegelman. And for that and many other reasons, we are very happy to have her on the show today. We would like to first begin with Professor Hirsch to discuss the Art Spiegelman retrospective, which, just as a point of information, our listeners can still catch before it closes on the 23rd of March, which is at the Jewish Museum Uptown, the former Warburg Mansion on 5th Avenue and 92nd Street. Let's begin, Professor Hirsch. This exhibit is Spiegelman's first retrospective, but in many respects his work appears to be consistently meta-retrospective in that he's always drawing and writing about his own past, his upbringing, his past as a pioneer in the comics wing of the counterculture. Do you view this as a symptom of an inclination to recycle instead of a career filled with more output, a more prolific career? Or is this, if in your mind, a satisfying, self-critical, productive pose?
Well, it's a great question, and in fact, it is his first retrospective. It's not the first venue for the retrospective, because it was already seen in Angoulême in France and in Vancouver at the Centre Pompidou, so it's coming late to New York, strangely. I think if you see the show, I don't think you would say that it's all about himself. It's really, it certainly is a picture of a very varied and quite productive career. But, of course, he is the center of a lot of it, his life. And I think there's several ways of looking at this question. One is to say that he's a memoirist, and that's what memoirists do. They write memoirs or produce work that's centered in some respects on the self. And, of course, in the show, Maus is at the center of the show, so, and that is his own not graphic novel, as the show itself presents it, but graphic memoir. But then in other ways, Spiegelman, as we see in the show, is also a collector, an archivist, a promoter of comics. He republishes things that were previously published in different kinds of venues. He brings things return because they were published in unknown venues, and he makes them more visible. So it may seem like he keeps coming back to some of the same things, but that's what archivists and collectors also do, and promoters of lesser-known genres. So I think it's really both of these that are important here. But then, of course, there is a whole other side of his work that you see in the show early on. For example, his work with Topps, with the Topps company, and his production of Garbage Pail Kids, and you know, sort of a 20-year collaboration with bubblegum wrappers and collecting collectors' cards for kids. There's a whole later venture about producing children's books that use comics for children's literacy, and then there are also collaborations. He's making an opera and collaborations with the Palabolas Dance Group with Philip Johnston, jazz, a jazz performance. So there are many, many different aspects of his work, and I would not say that this is recycling.
It's a very helpful overview of the diversity of the contents of the exhibit, and thank you for mentioning the collaboration with Philip Johnston. In conjunction with the exhibit at the museum, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, there was, I think, the only reproduction of a multimedia presentation that had previously been made for the Sydney Opera House. And in it, it was a kind of history lecture, and absolutely Spiegelman showing himself to be a great promoter of his genre, which we'll talk about more in a moment. But he claims in this presentation the mantle of pre-war European graphic woodcut novels, which is, I think, a genre not entirely familiar with contemporary audiences, but certainly exponents such as Lynn Ward in the United States, though trained in Europe, Franz Masuriel from Belgium, and these incredibly dramatic works that function on a very different size and scale, and of course did not make use of any language to tell their stories. And Spiegelman, of course, claims a kind of continuity or a prehistory in these works. Do you see this a strong connection?
You see it in the show and also in the wordless lecture performance that was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music and then also performed in Chicago. That's certainly one kind of continuity that he claims and that he also wants to claim. Through claiming it, he also wants to bring these artists back into visibility. As you said, they're not very well known. He's, of course, already republished some of Lynn Ward's work with an introduction and, you know, has paid homage to him. There's continuity, but there's also homage. I think that this wordless show is a deep reflection, really like an academic lecture on the narrative possibilities of the graphic genres, whether with or without words. And, of course, Spiegelman is kind of setting them to word and to music in his lecture and through Philip Johnson's music. So, yes, I think there's definitely continuity there, but he also puts them together with artists who are really quite much lesser known, like Cy Lewin, who did a kind of Holocaust wordless drawing sequence, which is totally unknown. So I think this is one of Spiegelman's strengths, is to bring together a variety of different artists. And if he claims continuity with Mazzarel and Lynn Ward, he's also claiming continuity with Mad Magazine, and he's claiming continuity with George Gross, and he's claiming continuity with Daumier and political cartoons. And it's really, he's drawing on so many different predecessors and precursors.
Great point, and a very rich response. He's been called critically recently the most pretentious faux artist, with this seemingly obsessive pursuit of high art within pop culture, and I think claiming the mantle of the graphic woodcut novels of the pre-war era is part of that campaign or process. How do you see, has he really productively enlarged the franchise of high culture? Of course, it's perhaps too premature to see that. Is he really bringing his audience into an awareness of whether it's pre-war modernism of various kinds, Daumier, Gross, people who you had just mentioned, helpfully, or is this is it leading to an engagement, or is this another nail against the rigorous engagement with large works of prose and fine art? And to the another way of phrasing the question, perhaps more simply, is there seems to be no sequel to Mouse in terms of its size and its scope. Of course, it's singular in terms of its treatment of its subject matter. And really, that is the issue, is can the genre sustain a rigorous large work such as Mouse on a continued basis?
Well, you're asking several questions at once. You know, I think the faux artist line comes from a, you know, very ungenerous, nasty review of from the New Republic by a reviewer who, you know, likes to create controversy and has headlines like that about a number of different things that are going on culturally. But I think the question is a deeper one. It has to do with the high art, low art, high art, pop culture divide, which I think has been kind of blown out of the water already, you know, probably towards the beginnings of the 20th century. You know, if we have Andy Warhol painting soup cans and we have Duchamp's toilets, and, you know, that's, Spiegelman is really right in that line. I think the real question you're asking is about the capacities of the graphic medium for telling these large-scale stories, which I think we already see efforts in some of the artists that you name, like Mazzarel and so on, is to tell you know, long stories in the graphic form. There may not be a sequel to Mouse in terms of quality, there really isn't, or power to tell a story like the story of the survival of the Holocaust and that its transmission into subsequent generations. But certainly Mouse has opened up ways of you know, drawing the graphic and the graphic medium into visibility, and I wouldn't say high culture or art or the museum, because I really don't want to see that distinction reified. But it certainly made it seem possible, and also created the aspiration for artists and writers to combine images and words in very innovative ways. And I think to suggest that you know, the word is superior to the image in creating narratives of historical importance is to be of a former century. I mean, we're living in a very visual era, and Spiegelman grew up on already mediated images of the histories that he's telling, and he's putting those to work to reach his audiences in a very different kind of way. But it's true that he breaks through distinctions that we kind of take for granted, distinctions between words and images, between the past and the present, between the real and the artificial. And I think that's one of the strengths of his work, is really to not accept any of the givens or truisms, not to take any of them for granted.
I think another way to approach the question and the issue that we're discussing here is within the perspective, let's say, of comic insiders, of aficionados, some of whom deem Spiegelman in a way to be more of a conceptual artist than a draftsman of truly stellar quality. And that kind of evaluation, of course, is really privy to, let's say, a kind of technical expertise that really only insiders after years of effort can establish. But it's interesting in the sense that certainly the self-consciousness about conceptual modern art movements applied to graphic novels is Spiegelman's. That seems to be part of his modus operandi. So the question is, and I'm not sure whether it really does make a difference, especially for those of us who really are not able to discern the quality of draftsmanship, but basically, Spiegelman's drawing is often deemed pedestrian in terms of his control of line, his painterly movement, compared to, let's say, Robert Crumb, as to mention a contemporary. Is that relevant? I mean, is the evaluation, because he brings to bear, as you mentioned, all of this kind of interpolating high art and popular culture so effectively, it seems, is that even relevant, that just from the bare mechanics of the control of his line, he really might not necessarily be in the category with some of his colleagues?
You know, it's not relevant to me and to, ways in which his work has been important to me and to my students, and I think to many, many readers. And I know that, people have made that judgment. But what I see when, if you go to the Jewish Museum show and you see his retrospective, you see just such a variety of drawing styles. And as we were saying earlier, of precursors and the evolution even of particular frames in Mouse, where, it's a very rich exhibit in terms of showing sketches for various pages. We see how that evolved from the hand-drawn to then the digital. And I think that you can't walk away from that exhibit without utter admiration for him as a draftsman, because of the variety of drawing styles. And then also the ability to pay homage to some of his predecessors, like Jules Pfeiffer, and then he can draw in that style. And I mean, there's just a tremendous versatility here that I think is absolutely admirable. Then, if you look at sketches, you see that he's really sketching like any painter, trying to get it right. The other thing I would say about his drawing style is his absolute obsession with accuracy when it comes to, some of the Holocaust representations and trying to get some of the details absolutely right through drawing, and that using models that are both photographic and then also narrative. So, and I think that somebody who's not a good draftsman would not be able to do what he did.
Absolutely. Let's turn now, finally, and I'm glad that you mentioned it for our last question, to turn to Mouse. And, of course, you pioneered the term post-memory and your work. Of course, there's also a Ukraine connection we can mention in light of contemporary events with your work on Chernivtsi, this, to some extent, lost to history German-Jewish enclave in Eastern Europe that was Austria-Hungary, then Romania, and is part of the Ukraine today. But let's turn also to your thoughts on Mouse. And, of course, it seems by all accounts that this will secure Spiegelman's reputation for the ages. But let's turn to the question of representation, which, of course, has been analyzed from so many perspectives, and the afterworld of the Holocaust and its memory. And to what extent Mouse, by, of course, using, just to remind our listeners, the classic Tom and Jerry, Cat and Mouse, applied to the Jews and Germans during the Holocaust, a reflection, is it a reflection of this hyper-mediated relationship of stages and of media and of images to the actual events themselves. And did it further, it seems like, a vehicle through which Maus greatly accelerated the absorption of the Holocaust as a part of really American popular culture, in a way, in a set of cliches, which on the one hand is extremely effective. And I'm wondering, now that I know, of course, you've written about it at the beginning and you've used it in your own work since with students, with the next generation, how do you see the process, let's say, looking back now, a decade, two decades hence, since its creation?
Well, it's really 25 years old, so it's definitely come of age, and many generations of students have read it and actually studied the Holocaust through it. I think one of the Holocaust and popular culture has a long history. The relationship of the Holocaust and popular culture has a longer, much longer history than Maus. We only have to think of the early Nazi movies. You know, starting in the 1950s, you get, you know, Nazis in films, in kind of cliched ways. So, you know, Maus didn't create that. I think Maus actually strangely slows things down rather than making the Holocaust easily accessible through a popularized medium. I think that it's really there's a really effective combination of medium and message here. And I think what the reason Maus speaks so well, perhaps not so much to survivors but to subsequent generations in transmitting this very difficult and painful history, is because it is already acknowledging the hypermediated relationship we all have to it. So the very first panel in the first Maus that Siegmund drew in 1972, way before he began work on the longer work, begins with a very well-known photograph that was shown in Life magazine by Margaret Bourke White of survivors in Buchenwald behind the barbed wire fence. And he inserts into that photograph a little arrow that identifies one of the prisoners as Papa, and he puts that little corner edges into around that photograph as though it were part of his own family album. And I think what he's trying to show here, or what he's transmitting, is that we don't have access to these painful histories that we inherit except through already mediated images that are part of our public image world, as much as some children of survivors might have them through narratives in their own families. But those public images and private images always work together somehow. So it seems to me that Maus actually complicates the transmission of a painful history like the Holocaust rather than simplifying it, by taking us out of our comfort zone in so many different ways, through visual punning, through verbal punning, through humor, through a number of techniques of defamiliarization. So when I first taught Maus in a class, it wasn't in a class on the Holocaust at all. It was on in a sort of introductory literature class to show students the complications of representation and the distances between the real and the work that they hold in their hands. So I think Spiegelman's conceptual work is precisely the strength of a work like Maus. Now, it's true that since Maus first came out, and the first one and then the second one, the Holocaust has become a much more popularized history. And I think that if you put together films like Schindler's List and some of the recent films that have come out with Maus, you will see that actually, you can use Maus to complicate rather than to complicate the history in relation to them.
Fascinating, wonderful. Professor Hirsch, thank you so much for your time. Very glad to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Take care. The station is WBAI, your host Adam Sachs, the show Beyond the Pale. Once again, listeners, cherished listeners, the power comes from you, the people. Please don't hesitate to pledge. 212-209-2950. Dig as deep as you can. We have, as an acknowledgement, some premiums for you. Two packages. $150 will get you Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, a book with a CD, Capitalism Hits the Fan, and another CD, Law and Disorder, The Archives of 2011 to 2013. For the same value, as an acknowledgement, we have the Winter Fun Drive Pack. Not only is it best of BAI on a 4GB flash drive, it's also a baseball cap and a t-shirt, and you will hear voices from the 40s, 60s, 70s, and onward. So both of those as an acknowledgement. And we do encourage you to please give as much as you can, as often as you can. Now we are turning to the very tumultuous events in Ukraine, with headlines, of course, changing every day, even today, questions of whether Moscow will tighten the spigot in terms of the gas that serves most of Europe and, of course, runs through pipelines in the Ukraine. And, of course, Ukraine and Russia, oddly, of course, were really in a way like England and Scotland, were joint partners in the world power effort that, of course, was the Soviet Union. And for a whole variety of issues, that relationship has seemingly begun to spin out of control. And, of course, the history that Ukraine joins with the Jews in Europe is extremely dramatic, in the sense that for many centuries they shared the status as the two largest minorities without a state, people dispossessed of sovereignty. Of course, the difference being that Ukrainians lived on contiguous territory in the southeastern section of Europe, in a similar sense of the way the Kurds in the Middle East occupy a similar geographic and strategic locale. But the Ukraine did have two moments of emergence of semi-sovereignty when the Cossack Hetmanate, so they're essentially tribal military organizations, emerged as brief transitional powers, once in the 17th century in the war between, the northern war between Sweden and Russia against the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth Kingdom. And the emergence of their leader, who is still considered a national hero, Bogdan Khmelnytsky. And then later in the 20th century, after the collapse of the Russian front in the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution that, of course, led to a civil war and at the same time also a Russian-Polish war, and in that interregnum there emerged, under Simon Petlura, another brief Ukrainian independent republic. Now, what's notable is that Khmelnytsky and Petlura, that are both Ukrainian national heroes, were also the greatest massacres of Jews in European history occurred under both of these gentlemen's watch. So today, of course, they're great heroes, but this gives you a sense of the potential charge when discussing Ukrainian uprising, Ukrainian national aspirations, and the fears and the anxieties of neighboring countries, but of course, specifically in what we're here to talk about today is with Ukrainians, Russians, and Jews. We have welcomed a great honor and pleasure to welcome Dr. Mikhail Nemirovsky to the show today. Welcome, Dr. Nemirovsky.
Hi, Adam. Hi, dear listeners. I'm ready to talk to you.
Wonderful, wonderful. Let me give listeners a little bit of your background. Dr. Nemirovsky is the director of Russian-speaking Jewish community development at the Jewish Community Relations Council and chairman of the board of directors of the American Office of the World Congress of Russian Jewry. So he's really working toward the essential problems of integration for Russian-speaking Jewish immigrants into American Jewish life, into American life, a very active leader of the Jewish community, also, of course, a colleague in the sense that he was the editor-in-chief of the Russian Forward newspaper, and he actually holds a PhD in technical science, and he was a professor at the Technical University in the Ural in Russia and vice president of the Jewish Federation of Russia. Let's begin a little bit. I think it's fascinating, Dr. Nemirovsky, every individual in your community has their own story that's of value and worth and dramatic in terms of how they escaped the crumbling Soviet Union and came to the United States. Would you share the listeners a little bit about your own background and a little bit of your own experience in Russia and Ukraine?
Thank you, Adam, for asking me for my short bio. I would like to tell you, you're right. Everybody who came from the former Soviet Union here in America has his own story about his life in the former Soviet Union and the story of his emigration to the USA or to Aliyah to Israel. You know, I was born in Moldova, a year after the end of the Second War. And my father, he is a veteran of the Second World, like a lot of veterans here in the USA, Americans, they can understand each other about the death, about the peace, and about the situations in Russia and Ukraine. They know each other, they can explain each other this the situation. When I graduated the school with the gold medal, I couldn't come to the university in Kishinev because the anti-Semitism was so high. I decided to go to Russia. I was in Siberia, in Ural. I was a student, and after that I became a scientist in Russia, and I was a teacher in the university. But it was so hard to live in Russia in the 90s, in the 80s, not because anti-Semitism, because it was so hard to live in Russia in this time, because it was a huge banditism, it was a huge less money problems, etc., etc. We decided to go, and when I was in Russia, I decided to work in the Jewish community to erase the interest of the Jewish community to Israel, to their roots, to the history of the people, because nobody gave us the permission in the time of the Soviet Union to know this, to know the language, to know the literature, to know the music, etc., etc. I became vice president of the organization VAAT. It's the Jewish community organization of Russia. We did a lot of job to bring people to the Jewish roots, to give them the first knowledges about the democracy. It was very interesting, but the anti-Semitism became unforgettable for me right now. It's unforgettable for me, this anti-Semitism. I decided to go because I had three daughters. It was so dangerous to have them in this time in Russia. And I'm 17 years here in America. I'm working very hard for the newspapers, for the TV, for the radio. I'm working in the Jewish Community Relations Council. It's one of the best organizations which I know, and I'm very glad to be here together with you.
Thank you, Dr. Nemirovsky, and it's very enlightening for us to hear it. Now let's turn to the communities, to the Russian-speaking emigre community in New York City, specifically, of course, those many of whom of Jewish origin. How might they see things differently than the American-born, Jewish or not, in terms of the media's portrayal of how Russia is presented in the news, of how this conflict with Ukraine is presented? I'm wondering in what cases their own experiences, their own thoughts, and of course, as you know, you're privy to the large media in the Russian language in the New York area. I wonder how those newspapers are depicting things differently. And to follow up, what do you think members of that community would want to tell the larger New York American public that they might not know about the background to what's going on in Ukraine and Russia today?
It's a very interesting question. Can I give you a short observation of the Jewish community, Russian-speaking Jewish community?
Please.
Because the Russian-speaking Jewish community has four ethnic groups, the Bukharian Jewish people, the Georgian Jewish people, the Ashkenazi Jewish people, and the Mountain Jewish people. Only one group of them, I'm talking about the Ashkenazi Jewish people, knows very well what means Holocaust. Because we lost millions of Jewish people in the former Soviet Union in the time of Holocaust. The people was murdered, the people was shot, hanged, burned, and raped. I know this very well because my family lost 21 members of the family in the time of Holocaust. My father, he was a veteran, I told you, and I know together with all my Jewish people from the former Soviet Union, I know very well the time of Holocaust, what's happened in the time of Holocaust. And the situation in Ukraine and Russia now, it looks, what to say, just a moment, I will try to say, it's not a surprise for us.
Okay.
It's not a surprise for us. Why? Because a lot of our Jewish families, they know, not only not only Germans, they killed people. A lot of betrayers of the Ukrainian people, a lot of divisions of the Ukrainian people. Division SS Galichina, they killed 10,000 Jewish people. They are guilty in this case. And they were, I remember my Boba, my grandma, she told me the stories about the Germans and about the Ukrainian murderers who did everything to kill our Jewish people. And they know, when I talk to the people and they told me, look, a lot of new nationalists, new neo-Nazis, etc., they are also members of the people who now was on the Maidan and the right sector, right-wing sector.
Hmm.
They are afraid about this situation because they can come back and they can do the, their crimes like was in the Second World War II.
It's, and Dr. Nemirovsky referred there to the Maidan, the main square in Kiev, where really the front line of these protesters and the right-wing sector, an organized political nationalist group that is behind a lot of the protests, it should be mentioned, of course, really armed to the teeth, better than perhaps a lot of police forces. These protesters were armed and violent and ready for confrontation, in fact. And Dr. Nemirovsky, if you can share with us some of the concerns you've heard from your community members, and I'm wondering in particular if you know of or have heard, let's say, people who have family in Kiev or Crimea that are speaking to them. Are there those kinds of direct effects between people in New York and people over there? And what are the concerns? What kind of worries do they have here in New York about the situation?
First of all, the our community, immigrant community, is not only the Jewish community. You have 225,000 Jewish people who came to New York, and this is less than a quarter of the whole Jewish community right now of New York. It's a huge number. But we have not only the Jewish people here in New York. We have Georgian people. You have Crimean Tatar. Yesterday in the evening, Adam, it's very interesting. I was invited to a meeting of Crimean Tatar. They have their center, cultural center in Moscow. They have in Bora Park, in the Jewish place of New York. For many years, from the 60s of the past century, they have their center. And they know the whole story about their people. They were, if you know, the Crimean Tatar, it's a natural people from this peninsula Crimea. But they were, in the time of the war, Stalin did everything to send them to Siberia, to Ural, and they lost a lot of people, and they are very against the new Russian ideas to become more and more the owners of the peninsula Crimea. They told me yesterday, we would like to be together with Ukraine, and Ukraine can be our country. They have tight connections with people who live in Crimea, Crimean Tatar, the Nazi Tatarian groups, and they told me, we are together with our brothers and sisters in Crimea. They would like to live in Ukraine, and we will support them. I know this for sure. Yesterday, I talked to many, many people of them. The Jewish community of, not only Jewish community, the immigrant community of New York, most of the people are together with Ukrainian revolutionaries. Because the situation in Ukraine, it was so negative. A lot of crimes. The people, the leaders of the party of Yanukovych party, they were against many of the relations of Ukraine with European Union. Yanukovych, you know, he has his crime. In the past time, he was one of the crime leaders. And the people from Ukraine, they know very well the situation. And they told me, you know, Putin, who is the leader of the Russia, he is not an anti-Semite. He is a pro-Jewish guy, and his teacher, if you know, it's very interesting. He has a teacher, an old woman in Israel.
Hmm.
And she is in the connection with this teacher. She is, she is Jewish, and they are in the connection. He gave her a gift, a house. He bought for her a house in Israel. But this is good. But the bad is the relations between the Russia and Ukraine. And this is not a surprise for us, because the relations between Russia and Ukraine wasn't good a lot of years, a long period of time. And this connected to many, many issues, not only national issues, but is connected to the business issues, is connected to the territorium issues, etc., etc. And plus, from issue to issue, they made everything to bring these two countries to the conflict. And it's not only the Russia is guilty in this conflict. This is the opinion of the many, many people here in America. I'm talking about the immigrants. This is the conflict between two countries, and both sides, they are guilty in this situation.
It's fascinating, very, very interesting. And to move towards that question, because there seems to be also, in addition to actual conflict, a conflict of words and a war of propaganda going on in the media between Ukraine, between Russia. And it seems to be that there's an attempt to spin the conflict in a way, again, linking current Ukrainian protests with, let's say, the grandfather generation that we mentioned, which made up of battalions in the Wehrmacht, divisions in the SS, helped to perpetrate the Holocaust. And then there's a way in which that Putin is portraying himself as a kind of savior for, or defender, let's say, of the Jews against anti-Semitism today. I mean, is there a little bit of truth in both of those depictions? And what I'm wondering about is, let's say, looking towards the future, what do you see for the Russian-speaking Jews that still live in those countries, that are still in Ukraine and in Russia, that decided to stay there, not come to the U.S. or Israel? And to what extent does this conflict impact their future, and what role they might have to play in that area of the world looking forward?
It's an interesting question. Thank you, Adam, for this question. But I can explain you something. And you know, in Ukraine you have not less than 250,000 Jewish people. It's a regular number. And 200,000, maybe less or more or less, in Russia. And the Jewish diaspora, the Jewish people who lives out of the Israel, and Israel together, they have a special ideas and program what to do if the situation will become very negative, and they would like to organize everything to bring the Jewish people to Israel. First of all, to Israel. Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, he told us that he has a special program, special project, and they are ready to do everything to bring in short time the Jewish people from the Ukraine who would like to emigrate to Israel. They will do this. I don't know about another countries, but I know the Jewish organizations, the leader, umbrella organization, like All Jewish Congress, All Jewish Committee, Jewish Community Relations Council, UGA Federation, etc., they are ready to be not only the sponsors of this process, but to do real job to save Jewish people if the situation will become negative. And I know this because I participated in the many meetings and conversations about the situation. Can be danger, but you know I'm optimistic guy. I would like to tell you, Adam, I believe everything will be peaceful. Now it's not 19th century. We should know the people can talk to each other. The situation is not deadly. The situation can be improved.
Thank you. On that word, well, and in hope of optimism for the future, we thank you for your time, Dr. Navarovsky. Wish you well, and thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, listeners.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now we move to a recent salute to Gustav Mahler by the electronic music artist Fenej that recently took place in Carnegie Hall. And in a way, it's an homage to a fellow Viennese of the past from a Viennese of today, although taking place in New York, which is, of course, quite interesting because Gustav Mahler has the unique distinction. Not only was he really the last symphonist of the Austro-German classical tradition, which essentially came to an end with his passing, but he was also one of really the only major European cultural output who actually transplanted his entire career from the old world to the new, from Vienna to New York. Now, Mahler had perhaps the most prestigious position in the music world of his day, which was the director of the Hofoper, the court opera house of Vienna. And after a decade there, he then decided, on the invitation first of Walter Damrosch and then Otto Kahn, to come and originally to take over the Metropolitan Opera, but then later, after he came to New York, he was invited to take over the New York Philharmonic. Now, both institutions, the Metropolitan Opera and the Philharmonic, used Mahler's arrival as an occasion for a complete overhaul, a complete reconsolidation, a change of their structure, which is, by the way, it modernized, professionalized the structure, and essentially it's the form that we know both of these institutions today. So it's quite interesting that Mahler, perhaps unwittingly, became a kind of vanguard for the flight of especially Central European, German-speaking artists and intellectuals and writers, most, of course, Jewish, coming from Europe to the United States, that, of course, would be in even greater droves. And, of course, although Mahler himself was enormously privileged, at the same time he was on the receiving end of a great deal of abuse in Vienna from the media of his day, especially, of course, for anti-Semitic reasons. Let's first give a listen to these very contemporary stylings. And, of course, interesting today that Vienna is no longer a great bastion of original composition in the classical style, but rather the electronic style. And I think you'll hear a kind of combination of past and present right now. you may hear the echo of the stylings of perhaps the one piece of Mahler that has really firmly lodged itself in popular cultural consciousness, the Adagietto of the Fifth Symphony, this kind of excruciatingly slow movement that is most famously heard on the soundtrack to Death in Venice, the film adaptation of Thomas Mann's novella, which it's a soundtrack of a kind of repressed desire, really. And it's the stylings, the other echo being, in a way, a kind of new age, a reflective therapeutic element in the music, which is, in a way, highly relevant, and I think that Fanesh is most aware of this, that Mahler is also one of the kind of complicating distinctions about his work. He's one of the very few composers that experienced a wholesale revival outside of his original context. I mean, largely, of course, because of the Nazis and World War II, Mahler wasn't heard in Europe for several decades, and it was really his centennial, and of course led by Leonard Bernstein, to whom we have to thank for the great reemergence of Mahler. Mahler entered popular awareness again, not necessarily as a kind of critical modernist continuation of the symphonic tradition, but really as this kind of soundtrack to modern life, and specifically its therapeutic and its almost, let's say, zen-like practices that, of course, were also quite popular in the 1960s. So in that sense, it was a kind of fortuitous dovetailing of certain trends in popular culture with Mahler emerging out of classical music. And I think that Fenech's depiction sonically recently at Carnegie Hall reflects that as well. So before we bid farewell, we want to also bring to your attention a production ongoing now at Baruch College, on Lexington Avenue and 25th Street, of the National Yiddish Theater, the Volksbühne. It's the Megillah of Itzhak Menger. And before we turn to that production, just to say a couple of words that the, of course, Volksbühne goes back almost a century. I think next year is their centennial, 1915. And what's quite notable, the word itself, Volksbühne, basically means folk, people, Bühne from the word Bühne, meaning stage, so a stage for the people. And it grew out of course, a culture, an eclipsed culture of social democratic politics and activism and culture that once flourished in New York. And, of course, we still have, in addition, the Vorwärts, meaning progress, forward in that sense, moving forward with progress, both of whom, by the way, were modeled on identically named institutions of the social democratic movement in Germany that had its newspaper called Vorwärts and its theater movement called the Volksbühne, the People's Theater. And what this was really was an entirely new model. It introduced a subscription model, democratic seating, with a kind of pedagogical focus in its programming as a means of educating the masses, of extending education and learning into adulthood, continuing education via the medium of live performance and theater, and updating classics to make them more accessible and more meaningful and contemporary. And I think that you'll see that this production does a lot of the same in the sense that it updates. This was a creation of the 1930s of a Yiddish playwright, Itzhak Menger, who updated the classic Purim story, which is really the origin of theatricality and the carnivalesque in the Jewish tradition, updated it to a modern mid-20th century Polish circus troupe, adding a lot of fascinating extra-biblical details. All we can encourage you to do is to please go and support the Volksbühne. And before we bid a fond farewell to you today, we again encourage you to take advantage and please call Support BAI, our listener-supported free speech radio. The power is with you and comes from you. And on that note, we bid you a fond farewell, and we welcome you to continue listening to Sheldon Walden and Walden's Pond. Thank you.
Do you remember that rainy night together at the gate? We didn't mind the weather.
And the fool I am, I said,
Let's elope to Vienna.
You said we couldn't leave your uncle Mordecai behind.
He'd be mad.
And you blushed and said, all right, then let him.
And now you sit atop a dismal tower in the throes of a tyrant who had butchered your predecessor. To sway an immovable force? You'll try. And they'll write stories about you. You're destined to live on forever.
And nobody will know my name. I am Fastragosa the Tailor, who once held...
I'm Marilyn Kleinberg-Niemark, co-host of Beyond the Pale, WBAI's program of Jewish culture and politics. Join the steady stream of WBAI Buddy monthly subscribers.